From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, hip-hop artist and actor Mos Def. He's co-starring in the new thriller 16 Blocks as a petty criminal set to testify before a grand jury. But first, he has to make it there alive. Also, we remember science fiction writer Octavia Butler. She died last week at the age of 58. Butler was the first science fiction writer to be honored with a MacArthur Fellowship. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by Sam Rivers, whose credentials include traditional and free jazz. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the five contenders for the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Mos Def first became known as a hip-hop artist and continues to do quite well in that arena. His 2004 CD, The New Danger, was nominated for a Grammy. But he's also made a definite impact as an actor. He's worked his way up from bit parts on the TV shows The Cosby Mysteries and NYPD Blue, and hosting and co-producing HBO's Def Poetry Show, to major roles in some ambitious, very diverse films. His parts have ranged from the intense surgical student in Something the Lord Made and the band leader in Lackawanna Blues to the alien from outer space in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He's appeared in The Monster's Ball, The Italian Job, and The Woodsman, and right now is hitting movie screens in two new films simultaneously. One is Dave Chappelle's Block Party, in which Mos Def takes the stage as one of the performers at Chappelle's Film for Posterity celebration. The other film is 16 Blocks, in which Mos Def co-stars with Bruce Willis and David Morse. Willis plays Jack Mosley, a cop who's trying to escort a witness safely across a short but dangerous stretch of New York City to testify, while others are out to prevent his arrival. Mos Def plays the reluctant, understandably wary witness, who, after dodging several bullets, also dodges his escort. The cop finally finds him on a subway platform, but the witness no longer wants to cooperate.
Hey!
Oh, no.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
What are you running away for? What do you want from me? It's too much, man. Look, I'm doing the rest of this on my own, okay? I'm doing what I said I was going to do. I'm getting out of here.
If I can find you, they can find you.
I'm doing what I said I was
going to do. If I can find you, they can find you.
Eddie, listen to me. Listen to me. Listen to me. I'm your only friend out here, all right?
You're my friend.
I can do this. Hey, listen to me.
You're my friend. You don't even know me. And get me where? You're going to get me shot. Ever since I've been with you, people been trying to shoot me. People you know. Look, man, I got someplace I need to be. I got something I need to do. And unless you're going to shoot me and arrest me right here, I'm going, Jack Mosley.
Can't let you leave.
You understand? Thank you, Jack Mosley. I'm going.
You cannot leave.
Thank you. Yes, I can. Thank you, Jack Mosley. Stop. Don't do that. Stop.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're not going. Let me come here.
Stop.
Eddie!
Terry Gross spoke with Mos Def in 2004. Before we hear their conversation, let's listen to something from his first solo CD, Black on Both Sides, recorded in 1999. This is his rap, Mathematics.
It's dangerous to dream, but your chain cats get they chip back. You dead now. Killing fields need blood to graze the cash cow. So numbers game, but don't add up somehow. Like I got 16 to 32 balls to rock it, but only 15% of profits. Ever seen my pockets like 69 billion in the last 20 years spent on national defense, but folks still live in fear. Like nearly half of America's largest cities is one quarter black. That's why they gave Ricky Ross all the crap. 16 ounces to a pound, 20 more to a key, a 5 minute sentence hearing and you're no longer free. 40% of Americans own a cell phone, so they can hear everything that you say when you ain't home. I guess Michael Jackson was right. You are not alone. Rock your hard hat black as you in the terror dome. Full of hard niggas, large niggas, dice tumblers, young teens in prison greens facing life numbers. Crack mothers, crack babies, and AIDS patients. Young bloods can't spell, but they can rock you a PlayStation. This new math is whipping my ass. You wanna know how to rhyme? You better learn how to add. It's mathematics.
Mighty Mos Def.
It's simple mathematics. Check it out. I revolve around science.
What are we talking about here?
Mighty Mos Def.
It's simple mathematics. Check it out.
What came first for you, acting or music?
What comes first, your left arm or your right arm? It's like they were, for me, from my experience, they were happening simultaneously. I was a young kid in the choir.
In church or in school?
In church.
Mm-hmm.
And in school. And, you know, when we would go for recess, I'd be in the schoolyard with my friends and my crew, and we'd be rhyming. And that continued all throughout my school career. When I was in class, rehearsing for a play, when it was time for lunch or after school, you know, it was time to write rhymes or listen to music, and it was just that seamless.
I want to play some music from your latest CD. It's called The New Danger.
Yes.
And this CD is kind of brings together hip-hop and rock. I thought we'd play a track in which you actually sing.
And, oh, cool.
Yeah, and this is called The Beggar.
Oh, cool. Thank you. I love that song.
Yeah, I like that too. Say a little bit about the song. And
well, it's a song that I wrote with my band Black Tech Johnson. It's really organic. I mean, the drum line. We were just in the studio and Will started playing this really, that pattern. And it started as a jam session, and then everyone started playing together, and then I ran into the vocal booth and just kind of laid the lyrics down in two takes, and that was the entire song. What we looked at, we listened back to it, it was like, this is awesome. We loved it. I love it just for the simple fact that Dr. No, who's so well known for his electric guitar work, is playing such beautiful acoustic on the song, it's just really one of those magical moments that everybody talks about having or wanting to have during a recording, and we had several of those that are on the record, and some that aren't, but that's one that I'm really proud of. And I'm glad you're playing. Thank you.
Woman, you know I love you. Woman, you know just how I feel. Try to tell me that you don't know. When I know you know the deal. Woman, you know I love you. Woman, you know I care. Hey, you try to say I'm running game. You try to say, baby, you don't play fair. Oh, darling, if there's any in your mind, I want you to be sure. Hey. If you don't ever cheat me again, I want you to be sure that I love you. Oh, girl, oh, baby, I love you. Darling, I love you, hey. Oh, darling, I love you, hey. Turn the lights down low.
What was the music you grew up with?
Everything. From church hymns to rock radio to hip hop, of course, to dance hall and reggae and everything. I love music.
What was in your parents' record collection that exposed you to music you might not otherwise have heard?
Well, my parents weren't really huge record collectors. My mother or my father. My dad is a lifelong musician. He played piano, still does. Sang in North Boys Choir. And he and a close friend of his, an educator, had a group called Voices of the Folk and performed all of the early work songs, the slave songs and the chain gang songs and things like this. And when I was a young boy, I learned all of these songs, and as I got older, they let me perform with them. So everything that I learned about music, my relationship to American music comes from that, because so much of that is really like the genesis of blues and rock and roll and everything else that we know and love and misunderstand today. So I count that as like my musical education, those songs But I just had a curious mind, you know. I used to go to record shops, and whatever cover art appealed to me, I go, or what titles appealed to me, I'd pick them up and I'd listen, and that's how I, you know.
That's great.
Spend a lot of my allowance.
what's one or two of the more unusual or ridiculous records you ended up buying solely because you like the cover art?
I had great success. I never was really disappointed. I mean, I brought Brilliant Corners by
Thelonious Monk. Yeah, uh-huh.
Because it was that five-sided picture.
Uh-huh.
I bought well, of course, every Miles Davis album that I could get. And I bought people and names that I was curious about that I hadn't heard. I wanted to know who John Coltrane was. I wanted to know who Miles Davis. I did a lot of you know, research on my own as a teenager, just listening to these people for myself. It's like someone telling you, you know, you got to go get this book. So I went to the library and checked out these books.
What led you toward jazz? Since it sounds like I know you were listening to everything, but certainly what your friends were mostly listening to was probably, you know, rap and hip hop, and that was probably what you're listening to on the radio. So what led you toward jazz?
It just always been around. You know my uncles and you know, elders in my community would turn it on, and it appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I heard it on the radio, I remember listening to BGO. It appealed to me, the images of those men, like Miles or Dexter Gordon, or they just appealed to me. And I guess it's the same reason that, you know, people that I picked up on rock and roll, because, you know, Jimi Hendrix is Dylan, or, you know, anyone else that, you know, any of the legends, or, you know, just seminal iconic figures, are very attractive spokesmen for the music. So you become interested on the basis that, you know, this collection of personalities or just figures. And that's what jazz was to me. It was this strange, attractive new world for me to go into. And I just dove in. I wanted to know. And I didn't come with any sort of expectations. I didn't know if it would be something that I liked at all, but I gave it a shot, and I loved it.
Mos Def, speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with actor and hip-hop artist Mos Def. He co-stars in the new movie 16 Blocks and appears in Dave Chappelle's Block Party. Here is Mos Def performing with his hip-hop group, Black Star, from 1998.
Is illusionary. Raise my son, no vindication of manhood necessary.
Not strong,
only aggressive.
Not free,
we only licensed.
Not compassionate, only polite.
Now who the nicest?
Not good, but well behaved.
Chasing after death so we can call ourselves brave.
Still living like mental slaves. Hiding like thieves in the night from life. Illusions of oasis making you look twice. Hiding like thieves in the night from life. Illusions of oasis making you look twice. I'm sure that everybody out listening agree that everything you see ain't really how it be. A lot of jokers out running in place chasing the style. Be a lot going on beneath the empty smile. Most cats in my area be loving a hysteria. Synthesized surface conceals the interior. America, land of opportunity, mirages and camouflages more than usually. Speaking loudly, saying nothing, you confusing me, you losing me. Your game is twisted, want me enlisted and your usury. Foolishly, most men join the ranks cluelessly, but foolishly accept the deception.
A lot of performers who are extraordinarily charismatic on stage or actually really shy in public life. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you were ever like that too, if you were ever...
I was painfully shy.
Really?
As a child. Like, you know, with like physical symptoms, the tightness in the chest, and just I was very, very shy as a child. And, you know, I wanted to make a connection with, you know, the rest of the world, but I was just, you know, very reserved and not quite sure how to do that.
Now, tell me a little bit more about your childhood, where you grew up. You grew up in Brooklyn?
Yes.
What was the neighborhood like?
Well, I was born in Downstate Hospital in Flatbush, and I was raised in Bedford-Stuyvesant and Roosevelt Projects. And then when I was around 9 or 10, moved back to Flatbush. And I'm a Brooklyn resident to this day. And I love my city. I feel blessed and lucky to have been born in a magical place on earth called Brooklyn.
What makes Brooklyn magical to you?
Well, I mean, everything. I mean, you know, Walt Whitman working at the Brooklyn Eagle.
Is that a newspaper, the Brooklyn Eagle?
The Brooklyn Eagle was an abolitionist paper in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. It's just rich with history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it is the New York experience on a very homegrown level. It's not metropolitan New York, and it's family-based. People who have been there, people who are there have been there for a very long time. You know, myself included in my family. So it's home in every sense of the word. And it's just got dynamic things. I mean, from the bridge to the Brooklyn Children's Museum, the first children's museum in the world.
I used to go on class trips to that museum.
Fantastic places in Brooklyn. The library, the botanical garden,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Prospect Park. It's so much there. I mean, I could go on and on and on.
Now, among the things that you do, among your talents, is that you also play instruments.
Yes.
Several of them. Bass, vibes, keyboards, percussion?
Yeah, I play bass, drums, keys. I can figure my way out on most instruments. I'm not good with any wind instruments at all. I tried to play the trumpet, and I quickly gave that up.
You know, a lot of people worry that because rap so often samples music as opposed to having live musicians playing behind them, that...
I think that's a misconception.
Do you? Because a lot of people worry that young people aren't learning instruments anymore.
As a matter of fact, it is a misconception because the Sugar Hill Gang is the seminal. I mean, there is no hip-hop without them, and that was a proper session band as much as the Muscle Shoals session band or the Motown session band, all of those... Curtis Blow records, all of those Sugar Hill records that people hear are live musicians playing. The element of sampling is actually a phenomenon of the budgetary cutbacks in the school system. And when I was in public school as a grade schooler, and there were music programs that were there and that just mysteriously disappeared. And that creative impulse was still in the community, but there was no outlet for it. There were no places for young people to go to learn to play instruments, and parents could not afford to even do that for their children. So this generation made do with what was available, which was their parents' records, and they made their own songs or versions of those songs because that was all that there was available. Nobody was saying, play this or play that. And in the mix of all of that, there was still a lot of... what that created was it created connoisseurs. It created these young people who were becoming knowledgeable about music via the advent of sampling. So you would go to a guy's house and these guys have hundreds and hundreds and sometimes thousands. I know guys with thousands of records from everywhere every stripe and variation that you can imagine, because they're all, as Africa Vambaataa said, looking for the perfect beat, wherever that may be. And I've heard some of the most fantastic, exotic, obscure, amazing music in the basements and homes of hip-hop producers. And sampling is not as easy as people would imagine. But, you know, to quote Fidel Castro, had a great quote after he was captured in his first attempt to overthrow Batista. He's in his prison cell. He said, "History will absolve me." So whatever misconceptions that people have about the culture or its origins, before it's all done, people will understand it clearly. I'm confident in that.
Mos Def, speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. He's appearing currently in two new movies, performing in Dave Chappelle's Block Party and acting opposite Bruce Willis in the action drama 16 Blocks. To close, let's hear Mos Def performing Universal Magnetic from the soundtrack of Block Party. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Everybody get ready, the universal magnetic beat. Don't stop.
Rock on, yeah, to the rhythm, you don't quit. Yeah. Yeah.
Y'all wanna thank Dave Chappelle?
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luc Sant, available in stores and online. From Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember the acclaimed science fiction writer Octavia Butler, who died last week at the age of 58. Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by the 80-something jazz musician Sam Rivers. And David Edelstein reviews the five films up for an Academy Award in the Best Foreign Language Film category. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. When jazz musician Sam Rivers was in his 70s, he left the New York suburbs for warm and sunny Florida. But Rivers didn't go there to retire. Since moving to Orlando a decade ago, he's made a steady stream of records with small and large groups. In 2004, he returned to New York for a session that's yielded a couple of CDs. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new one.
When Sam Rivers popped up on record in the 1960s, jazz musicians were split into those who played in and them what played out. The ones who played by established bebop rules and the ones more inclined just to wing it. Rivers' free jazz credentials are impeccable, with umpteen all-improvised trio dates behind him. But along the way, he also worked with Billie Holiday, Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, and blues man T-Bone Walker. The new CD, Violet Violets, bridges the inside and outside worlds of Sam Rivers. It's a freewheeling trio date with some open improvising, but also that blues, some original tunes, and good old good ones by Lucky Thompson and Ornette Coleman. The band isn't Rivers' working trio, but a one-shot co-op with New York bassist Ben Street. Danish drummer Creston Osgood organized the date. This session already produced the CD Purple Violets, also on Denmark's Stunt label, and like it, this sequel's a bit rough at the edges. Not that roughness doesn't have its uses. That spontaneity is part of the music's charm. The 10 shortish pieces feel more like pencil sketches than attempted masterworks, a point unwittingly underscored by the bad homemade cover art. Now in his early 80s, Sam Rivers still has a commanding presence on tenor sax, the odd shaky moment aside. He gets a rich, chocolatey tone, and as a soloist, he's always looking to break old patterns and find his own way to comment on a melody. This is from What a Difference a Day Makes. Besides tenor, Sam Rivers also plays soprano sax and flute here. I'm not alone in liking his tenor best, and it's heavily featured on Violet Violets. Many saxophonists play both tenor and soprano, but Rivers is among the very few who started on the smaller, higher horn. He played soprano back when almost nobody did, before Coltrane got one. That may be why his snake charmer sound wears better than most. I'll give you a sample. But listen to the bass and drums, too, for how expertly they buoy Rivers up, changing tactics from moment to moment without losing momentum. They make the trio's music a real conversation. From time to time, Sam Rivers has justly lamented that he's never gotten his due as an original saxophonist and dedicated free player. Yeah, or as composer for large and small ensembles, or patron of New York's loft jazz scene of the 70s. But one advantage of being an octogenarian is longevity gives folks plenty of time to wise up, and I hope Mr. Rivers is feeling the love by now. A few of his Blue Note and Impulse classics of the 1960s and 70s are in print, if you want to catch up on some other good stuff you missed. Better late than never.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas and is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Violet Violets by Sam Rivers on the Denmark label Stunt. Coming up, we remember Octavia Butler. This is Fresh Air. Octavia Butler, generally considered the most prominent and accomplished African-American author in the field of science fiction, died last week after a fall near her home. She was 58. Octavia Butler was the recipient of the biggest honors in science fiction, twice winning the Hugo Award and twice winning the Nebula Award. She began writing as a college student, encouraged by famed author Harlan Ellison and eventually becoming his protege. Her first novel, Pattern Master, was published in 1976. It told of a divisive society ruled by powerful telepaths called Patternists, and was the first of several books in a series. Among her other novels is the series she called the Xenogenesis Trilogy, in which the characters are not differentiated by gender. The settings for Butler's books range from the distant past to the far future. One of her most famous, 1979's Kindred, told of a modern-day black woman who traveled in time back to the antebellum South. In 1995, Octavia Butler was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship, often referred to as a genius grant. She was the first science fiction writer to do so. 2 years before that, she wrote the novel Parable of the Sower. The story is set in Southern California in the year 2025. The people lucky enough to still have homes build walls to protect themselves against crazy and desperate street people. Terry spoke to Octavia Butler when that book was published in 1993 and asked her about the tone of its imagined future.
The main character in your novel has what you've called hyper-empathy. In other words, she experiences other people's pain
as though it were her own.
As though it were her own. So in this very violent society, every time she's in proximity to somebody who has a gunshot wound or a stabbing wound, she feels that pain as mm-hmm. if she had been shot or stabbed.
Mm-hmm. But what I wanted to make sure that I wrote a novel in which everything that happened actually could happen. So none of this is parapsychological. There's no telepathy or anything involved. It's delusional. So it doesn't help her that it's delusional, that she only thinks she feels these things. But it is delusional on her part. It's a result of her mother having taken a drug.
I think part of what you're trying to say with this hyper-empathy is that if people really felt other people's pain, we couldn't possibly live in a violent society. It would hurt too much.
I thought so when I began writing the book. I honestly thought that was what I was going to wind up doing. I thought hyper-empathy was something that I would find some way to spread to other people. But somewhere in the book, I realized that, no, people would find ways. They would find ways to carry on violence. For one thing, the hyper-empaths are very vulnerable. They are, as my character's brother says, almost natural slaves. It's much easier to abuse them than to abuse other people.
Did that come at all from the knowledge that a writer has to be very empathic, or is the word empathetic?
I'm not sure which word. I know what you mean.
You have to really feel everything your characters are feeling, and you probably have to imagine the feelings of the people around you to mm-hmm. imagine what they're feeling so that you could write about it at some future point.
One of the things that I can remember in my growing up, writers mind their own lives. You've probably run across this mm-hmm. with others.
I try to mind their lives too.
Right. In my life, especially when I was very young, I can remember getting very upset about things that happened that seemed to be hurting people, and that weren't things that weren't upsetting anyone else. I can remember after a while, I used to watch a lot of television as a kid. And for a long time, I watched, cowboy shows or whatever, where people got beaten up or hit with chairs or guns or whatever. And at first, it meant nothing to me. And then we were in a car accident, and I got a hard crack on the head. And thereafter, I really empathized with anyone who was hit on the head. And I got so that I really didn't want to watch that for a while. I still don't like to watch it, but for a while there, I stopped watching that sort of television.
It literally hurt you
mm-hmm,
to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So this connects to the hyper-empathy.
Mm-hmm. I think probably most kids empathize too much at some point in their lives and have to grow out of it, are forced to grow out of it just to survive. And my character is a person who can't grow out of it and for whom it is literal. She doesn't just empathize in the sense of psychologically sharing, but she really seems to feel it physically.
You're one of the few African-Americans and one of the fewer African-American women writing in the genre of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
What speaks to you about the genre?
I write science fiction because, first of all, I like it. I always liked it. When I was a kid, I read it and enjoyed it, and it was one of the first things that I began writing. I also write it because it offers me such freedom. There isn't anything that I can't do in science fiction. Past, present, future, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, whatever. I can get away with all sorts of things in science fiction that might not go, and fantasy, I should say, that might not be that possible in trade fiction.
How have you addressed issues of race and gender in your books?
Well, for instance, I did a book called Kindred, in which a black character goes back in time to the antebellum South, not voluntarily, of course, and experiences slavery firsthand. Kindred is apparently still popular, still being used as a textbook in high school and college.
As a woman and as an African American, are there things that bothered you about the science fiction books that you read when you were first starting to read them?
Yes, I wasn't in them.
Yeah, right, right. And I don't know if this is just true of a certain type of science fiction movie and TV show, but it always seemed that when a type of male writer looked into the future, what he saw was women wearing a lot less with a lot more cleavage.
Right. Yeah, I read a lot of science fiction as a kid, and of course that meant reading boys' books,
mm-hmm.
because that's what kids' science fiction was. I made up my own stories to put myself in them. I wound up writing science fiction from the point of view of girls and women, just because I was a girl and I am a woman. I wound up writing science fiction from the point of view of black people because I am black. But I've also explored and in a strange sense, I suppose, found out what it might be like to be a white male or an Oriental or whatever. You know, one of the things writing does is allow you to be other people without actually being locked up for it.
We're talking empathy here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you entered the science fiction genre, were there a lot of women, were there a lot of African Americans reading science fiction? And did your publisher worry about your books finding a natural market?
When I got into science fiction, I sold my first three books without an agent and with no particular connections. I just mailed them in over the transom. So nobody knew who I was, and nobody knew I was black. And no, apparently there wasn't any worrying. I didn't have any difficulty selling my first three novels. When I wrote Kindred, which is unmistakably of special interest to black people, I had a lot of trouble. All of a sudden, 15 publishers couldn't find a place for it. They didn't know how to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have letters saying, oh, we really like it, it's wonderful, we just don't know what to do with it. Maybe you could make it a romance, or maybe you could make it a juvenile. They just had no idea how to sell it as what it was.
So how was it finally sold?
It was sold as a trade book, mainstream fiction, and pretty much ignored for a while, I guess. And then when Beacon Press brought it back, it all of a sudden began to get a lot of the attention that I'd hoped it would get originally.
Mm-hmm. Now, you grew up on a chicken farm in California.
Well, I lived there for about a year. Actually, I grew up in Pasadena, California.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, my grandmother had a chicken ranch. My father died when I was very young, and my mother, trying to get her life together, left me with my grandmother for a while. So I did have a chance to live on the chicken ranch for a little while.
What did your father die of?
Oh, overdoing just about everything.
What happened?
A huge man, ate too much, drank too much, mm-hmm. died young.
Mm-hmm. Was the farm a farm your grandmother owned?
Yes, yes. My grandmother was an amazing woman. She was an orphan, and she made her own way. She married very young. I think she was actually about 12 when she married. And she married a much older man and had several children. And he died and left her. Naturally, he was considerably older. And she had to make a way for her children. She was in southern Louisiana originally. She was doing things like cutting sugar cane and cleaning houses. And she made her, she left her children with relatives, went to California, found work cleaning houses and doing anything else that she could find, sent for her children, and kept working incredibly hard and began to buy property. And that's how she eventually wound up with the ranch and a house and a truck for hauling and several other things that should have been out of her reach, I think would have been if she had been a lesser woman.
You once said that you needed your fantasies when you were young to shield you from the world. What was especially bad about the world when you were growing up?
I think because my mother and her brothers and sisters grew up during the Depression and actually did know times when there was no food and when they were just about on the street, they had the idea that life, well, I suppose it's not that unusual an idea, that not only was life hard, but any job you could get, any work you could do, you should stick with it no matter how unpleasant it was. You should put up with any amount of tiresome behavior on the part of your employer. Life is hell and you have to put up with it. And then after you've put up with it for a while, you get to go to heaven. This didn't seem like anything I really wanted to grow up to.
That's sometimes a hard pattern to change.
I was an only child, and I was, I guess you could say, very much my own person. I kind of constructed my own world as I went along. I accepted the idea that you had to work for a living, but I didn't accept the idea that you had to do something you hated just because it paid.
But you know, writing must have seemed like a real long shot because...
Oh, gosh. Yeah, everybody in the family said, oh, you can write in your spare time and you can, you know, write as a hobby, whatever. But the idea of writing for a living was completely alien.
When you were young and started writing stories, were the adults ever worried about you because of the kinds of stories you were caught up in? Did they seem... unhealthy for a child?
My mother at one point took in elderly roomers, and I can remember telling them stories, and one of them in particular, my favorite old woman, she used to be a carnival mentalist, and I adopted her as the kind of step-grandmother, even though we were not related at all. My mother took in older people who weren't quite ready for the nursing home, but who didn't want to live alone any longer.
Uh-huh.
And had them as paying as roomers. She told my mother that maybe I was going a little far and maybe, you know, she seemed to think that I didn't know that I was telling stories, that they were fiction, and that maybe I actually believed them and maybe I needed a little help. So she was the main one who thought that maybe it was unhealthy for me to be doing that.
Well, tell me more about this carnival mentalist. Did she use a lot of trickery?
She was a wonderful old lady. She used to scare the heck out of me. I never knew her to use any trickery at all. She was just, she knew people. She'd been alive for a long time. She was an observer of humanity. And she knew how to hold your attention and she knew how to take you in.
How would she take you in? Do you remember any of the...
Well, it wasn't a matter of what she said. It was more her manner, that you just, you accepted her word for things. And if she told you something frightening, you worried about it. You definitely worried about it.
Did she give you things to worry about?
Only if I annoyed her, which I tended to do because I liked her. And I would kind of hang around and talk too much.
Now, she was the one who thought that you were maybe too taken up with the stories,
right? Mm-hmm.
Did that scare you? Did you think maybe you were?
No, not at all. No, I probably shouldn't have had... I didn't have confidence in myself in social situations, but I was confident within myself that I knew what was real, which is probably an arrogant thing for anybody to feel, but I did feel that I knew what was real, and I wasn't having any problems with my fantasies.
Octavia Butler, speaking to Terry Gross in 1993. The acclaimed science fiction author, whose books include Kindred, died last week at the age of 58. Coming up, David Edelstein on this year's foreign film nominees at the Oscars. This is Fresh Air. Every year, countries get to nominate one film to represent them in the Academy Awards race for Best Foreign Language Feature. This year's five nominees represent films from France, Germany, Italy, South Africa, and Palestine. Critic David Edelstein saw all five films and thinks he knows how the Academy will vote.
I have this theory about what makes a shoo-in foreign language film Oscar winner. The average Oscar voter starts watching the movie and says, "What is this language? Where am I? I can only handle so much foreignness." And then gradually, a recognizable Hollywood formula kicks in. So by the end of the picture, the same voter is saying, "That's me on screen." And more important, who's this director's agent? I don't mean to sound snarky. Well, maybe I do. It's just that the Oscars are not about merit alone. They're an election. And like any election, they come down to consensus. A foreign language Oscar is a good housekeeping seal of approval. Yes, the movie has to be good, but it's just as important that it's good for you. It's an especially noble batch of films in competition this year. Well, there's one that's either noble or venal, depending on whom you ask. Hani Abu Assad's Paradise Now, the story of two Palestinian suicide bombers. Right now, it's the target of a ferocious campaign in Hollywood led by the Israeli father of a young man killed by a bombing. In an open letter, he charges the movie with justifying the barbaric act. It's impossible not to sympathize with his rage. But the filmmaker clearly deplores violence against civilians and makes a lucid case against it. What the movie doesn't do is portray the would-be bombers as evil. They're shown as decent human beings driven to commit evil acts. Paradise Now isn't a great movie. If anything, its social responsibility weighs it down. It stops dead for debates and tidy civics lessons. But it's powerful and contemporary enough to deserve an Oscar. It won't win, though, because it's too divisive, even among the large number of liberal Jewish Academy voters. A more Jewish-friendly film, perhaps, is Germany's Sophie Scholl, The Final Days, based on the true story of a Gentile university student who defied the Nazis by passing out flyers condemning Hitler. The film is intense, a series of gripping interrogations, with a performance by Julia Jentz that's luminous. Oscar voters love political martyrdom, but Sophie Scholl is probably too austere for the Academy. And some voters might feel awkward passing up Paradise Now for yet another movie about how bad the Nazis were. The third nominee is Italy's Don't Tell, a fascinating mixture of romance, showbiz satire, and buried secret incest psychodrama. I liked it, but it doesn't quite gel and has no chance. The anti-war French nominee, Joie Noël, has a better shot. It's about warring World War I platoons, Scottish, French, and German, who agree to an impromptu ceasefire on Christmas Eve and then drag their feet about going back to shooting one another. The film is sentimental, but its sentimentality is juxtaposed against carnage, carnage that's graphic, agonizing, obscene. In a time of war, this film could move a lot of voters. but not as many as South Africa's Tsotsi, directed by Gavin Hood. The movie has all that foreignness I spoke of earlier. It's set in a shanty town. It opens with a horrifying robbery murder, and its main character, Tsotsi means thug, has a face that at first is unreadable, hard and cold. Well, Tsotsi steals a car and ends up with a baby, and the suspense is over whether he'll find what you might call the true meaning of Christmas. I'll tell you this. At a test screening I went to with an entirely white, upper-middle-class, mature demographic, there was a standing, cheering ovation. I cheered, too, even though the film is incredibly manipulative. Oscar bait doesn't come any juicier. I think it's a hotsy tsotsy year.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley. Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Borrowed Time, a novel of psychological suspense set in Britain by Robert Goddard. From the Susan and John Turbin Foundation for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. And from Warner Home Video, announcing the two-disc special edition DVD of Network, featuring a documentary on the making of the film. Available now. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we meet singer-songwriter Stuart Murdoch of the indie pop band from Scotland, Belle and Sebastian. Their new CD is The Life Pursuit. Join us for the next Fresh Air.